Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 18 of the Value Stocks podcast with your host, Alex Middleton and Felix Nothnagel. Today is March 4th, 2020, and we are talking about Rolls-Royce Holdings, symbol RR on the London Stock Exchange. Current market cap for Rolls-Royce is 11.73 billion pounds with an enterprise value of approximately 15 billion pounds. The stock is currently trading at a share price of £607, down from a high of just over $1,000 in August of 2018. Before we dive into the analysis, I'd like to introduce our first ever guest on this podcast, Eric Koop. He is calling in from Toronto. Eric, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Pretty good. So, Eric, you kind of brought this company to our attention, and how about we just start off with you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into investing, and we'll go.
Sure. So I'm a listener from Southwestern Ontario and an amateur investor. Growing up, I wasn't really very interested in investing. And initially, I went to university for nano engineering. But about after a year, I just kind of could tell that the glove didn't fit. So I took a year off school and worked a menial job, and in the meantime, read a bunch of books, and the one that stuck out the most to me was the Buffett biography by Roger Lowenstein. When I read that, it just kind of clicked that that was a life that I really wanted to emulate. It seemed like it fit with all my values and what I would like to do for the rest of my life. So from there, I read just a bunch of investing books and then began university for business finance. And now I spend all my free time just being devoted to studying companies and learning how to value businesses. Yeah.
So are you, you're still in school right now?
Yep. Still in school. Still got a little bit left to go.
Okay, cool. And, what kind of companies are you invested in right now? And tell us a little bit about your process and how you like to do your research.
Sure. So, when I started, I was really looking at the really statistically cheap companies, low PEs, low price to books, that sort of thing, kind of the Graham route, but over the past, I don't know, maybe half a year to a year, I've really been coming to realize that the people who make the most money are the ones that look for really great businesses. So I read books like Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits by Phil Fisher and 100 Baggers by Christopher Meyer, or, listen to speeches by Chuck Ockray. And those have really convinced me that the businesses with long runways and the ability to compound capital at high rates are really the ones I should be looking at. So I've looked at a couple of really cheap bargain bin companies, and now I'm trying to focus on the better ones, I guess you could say.
Great. All right. Well, let's dive into the podcast or the analysis here. And so, Eric, you brought us this company. You emailed us a while back and sent us a little bit of information on Rolls-Royce. Why don't you just kind of like go over what they do and what got really initiated your interest in the company?
Sure. So Rolls-Royce, they're an industrial technology company. They get most of their revenues basically from three divisions: civil aerospace, so they make big old jet engines. They make power systems, largely diesel engines and generators and things of that sort. And then their defense business, where they work making a lot of components for aircraft engines in various defense applications. Their main customers for civil aerospace are the large airlines, and for defense, they mostly split the revenues between the Ministry of Defense in the UK and the Department of Defense in the US. I first came across them because I was reading one of John Hempton's, he's an investor from Australia. He runs Bronte Capital. He was actually the Australian guy in the episode on Valiant on Dirty Money on Netflix. And he wrote about them on his blog, and then I chewed into it a little bit more, and I found a great write-up by a guy named Stephen Wood, who runs a investment firm called the Greenwood Investors. And from there, I've just been chewing into it ever since, and I thought I'd give it to you guys and see what you guys thought of it.
Oh, we certainly appreciate it. And I think, Felix, you kind of gravitated toward the investment idea a little bit before I did. I logged into our email account, and all of a sudden you guys exchanged about 40 different messages on the company. What kind of intrigued you there, Felix?
Yeah, pretty much the write-ups from Stephen Wood, and I guess seems like a high potential upside. So when you're kind of, when I see something where I'm like, yeah, I could see this trading at 2 to 3 times or 4 times its current stock price in like five years down the road, then something like that always kind of becomes interesting right away. And yeah, as I was digging deeper, I just kind of got more and more interested. And but then also as you dig deeper, then you also start kind of you're a little bit concerned about that, and you start thinking, okay, maybe this is a little bit optimistic. Maybe they can't create all that free cash flow that they're planning to do, that they're forecasting. But anyways, I guess that's why we're discussing this company.
Yeah.
I guess just a little expansion on the kind of what the business looks like. You already mentioned basically their different arms. Civil aerospace is about 50% of revenue, defense 20%, power systems 20%, and then another 10%. I think it's kind of like a aero something.
ITP aero.
Mm-hmm. I think they do services stuff around.
Yeah, it's 5% of total revenue approximately. But
yeah.
I think it's important to note to any listeners who aren't familiar with this company that it has nothing to do, at least financially in today's world, with the cars. That was separated, I think, in the 90s, eh?
I don't remember when exactly, but I know.
Yeah. It was sold from Vickers to, I believe, BMW in 1998, yes.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay, and so just for the history buffs out there, yeah, there's this company started out in the... I think 1904, they well, in the 1800s, and I think in 1904, Charles Rolls and Henry Royce joined a partnership. You know, they built their first planes in World War One, and then they grew from there. So, yeah, so right now the capitalization is just under 12 billion pounds. Do either of you guys have a position in this company today?
Yes, I have a position in this company. Out of my small net worth, I've maxed out what I'm allowed to based on, like, I basically put 10% of my small net worth into this company. Yes.
Right. And you usually are your positions usually split evenly when you initiate them?
Usually based on my conviction, okay. It'll be somewhere between 3% and 10%.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
I don't have a position right now, but I'm thinking about it, and I could see myself having a position in a month's time, in a year time. It's like, it's possible.
Right. Okay. Well, I don't have a position right now, and I'll leave a cliffhanger for the end to see if for listeners to see if I'll actually consider investing in the future. So they listen to the whole episode. So we kind of covered why we all wanted to research in this company. I guess I have left it out why I wanted to do some research in this company. It seemed like they were going through a short-term event with the Trent 1000 engines. You know, there's a lot of negativity and there's extra costs that they've been incurring because of the problems that they've had with this wide-body engine. I guess something else that interests me as well was that, you know, there's only real two major manufacturers of these wide-body engines in the world. So it's fairly an industry that's fairly protected from new entrants, which is highly attractive. And it's associated with the airline industry as well, which is, you know, growing faster than global GDP globally. So, you know, anything that's associated with that that seems attractive initially, especially when you see other companies that are doing riding that tailwind, kind of like airports or TransDigm, or even if it's the airlines themselves. Eric, do you have anything to add to that?
Sure. So the things that I liked in the business, I really like their business model. The way I try to think of their business model is they're effectively Gillette, but with jet fuel. So what they do is they sell engines to airlines at a loss. Right now they're losing $1.2 million for every engine they sell. But then for the next 25 to 30 years, those engines need maintenance done about every 5 years. And they lock these airlines into long-term contracts. And the long-term contracts are very, very valuable. And once they lock them in, it's essentially an annuity. And these service revenues are very predictable and they're growing as a percentage of revenue.
Right. So it's an attractive business in that front in terms of the way they set up their maintenance contracts. I guess as long as they get the costs right up front, what they charge for this maintenance, right? Because correct me if I'm wrong there, Eric, they charge on an hourly basis on the engines, right?
Yeah.
Operation hour?
Yeah. So the way that the contracts work are the airlines don't pay for every time they bring them into maintenance. The airlines pay for every single hour that the engine is flying. And then they recognize that revenue when the engine comes in for service. So that makes the service portion of the revenues cash flow negative, which is actually a nice little feature. Another thing that I like about Rolls is they have the most efficient wide body engine in the world. It's the Trent XWB. It has an overall efficiency of just over, and the 787 engines are at about 38, 39%. And it may not seem like a lot, but over millions of kilometers flown, all that fuel, all that kerosene cost being brought down by 3 to 5%, that's a huge competitive advantage for airlines that use their jet over, or their engine over another one.
So what is it? Isn't it like fuels like is 50% of their operational cost or something like that? I thought I read that somewhere.
Yeah, it's extremely high. And just to give some background on how efficient these engines are, the original engine on the turbojet, the 707 back in the 1950s, was only 22% efficient. So they've effectively doubled the efficiency of engines over the past 60 years.
Right.
I agree with the attractiveness of the business model. I think the only thing I'm thinking it's not quite as good as razor and blade. Also, I mean, I guess Gillette is losing a little bit of market share and is having their own issues with their kind of business proposition. But the problem is a bit, you still have liabilities, kind of like if the engine doesn't work, right? Like the Trent 1000.
Yeah.
Then you have all this cost. It's not like a razor blade that you just produce and then it's just getting used up.
Yeah.
So you have some kind of liability if those engines don't work well, and you have these long-term service agreements, and you have agreed prices. And I mean, Rolls-Royce, to my understanding, they're very conservative on when they make these long-term service agreements, but having an issue like the Trent 1000 definitely can destroy a lot of value.
Yeah, when they set these things up, they're relying on their testing data to predict reliability going forward, what their costs are going to be. And obviously with Trent 1000, they're very much off that on that. You know, in most cases, and I think in the past, it's worked very well. And I come back from a mining background, and they haul truck manufacturers can sign the same type of contracts with operators as well. So I've seen how profitable that type of business model can be. And, you know, especially with the cash flow that they collect up front when there's very little to no maintenance on the engines. And then they can hold that for a bit and then as float. And then when the actual overhaul happens, that's when they have to hopefully have the money there. And it's going to cost exactly what they thought it was going to cost.
Yeah, if you want to talk a little bit about the Trent 1000, that's really the biggest risk or negative. The reason why the Trent 1000 came up with so many issues was when they were initially doing all the testing on it, they tested it in their brand new factory, and the air in the factory was like you have air outside in, I think they were testing facilities in England in Derby. But I guess that when they were running planes over and over and over in some of the cities in Asia where they have high sulfur content in the air due to coal power plants being nearby, the sulfurization of the turbine blades caused them to become brittle and crack. So it's really something that's really difficult to predict, and it's just such a fluke, I would say. In terms of there being risk for their other engines developing issues in the same way, to my knowledge, so far, the Trent XWB has been running. It's their main engine, I would say. It's their main cash cow. It's been running for 5 years, and it has a 99.9% reliability rating. And the issues that developed on the Trent 1000 happened after 3 years. So it looks, at this point, like the Trent XWB will be spared any of the Trent 1000 issues.
Right.
And what about the Trent 7000, I believe?
Yeah, the Trent 7000 was based off the Trent 1000, except it's powering the A330neo instead of the 787. And they took a few preemptive steps to make sure the 7000 doesn't have the same issues as the 1000. But if it does somehow manage to develop similar issues, I'm not really that worried, because as of the start of 2020, they only have 114 delivered. And their MRO, which is a maintenance, repair, and operations capacity, has really expanded in the last few years due to the Trent 1000 issues. So if they had to do any fixes on it, there would be minimal issues for customers, and it would be over pretty quickly. I'm not too concerned about the Trent 7000.
Right.
Good. Do you guys want to talk about any other positives? I have a few more points.
Sure, go ahead.
So basically what I find attractive also is that the share price hasn't moved in the last 10 years.
Right.
It's kind of trading basically at the same price level as it did 10 years ago. It can be an issue, but sometimes also there's a lot of value created over 10 years. And I think in Rolls-Royce, that's the case. I kind of had a similar experience with Microsoft. When they were trading sideways for like 10 years, like early 2000s to like 2010 or something like that. And, or maybe even a little bit longer, I can't remember exactly. And then it really started taking off all of a sudden, but you could see the earnings growing and free cash flow growing. And it just, it didn't matter to the market for many years. And all of a sudden it's kind of share price kind of catches up with fundamentals. So I find that attractive, or it's worthwhile a look anyways. I find it has a very cheap price to sales ratio right now of 0.8. Like if you think it's a good business model and they would make like a net profit margin of like 10% or maybe even a bit higher, it shouldn't trade at lower than a price to sales of like 1. Mm-hmm. And if you look at some competitors, UTX, which owns Pratt & Whitney, and they own some elevator companies and things like that. I think they trade at a price to book of 2. And if you look at Safran, which is like in a joint venture with GE, it's like the competitor for the wide body engines. They're trading at a price to book of 2.5.
Right.
So yeah, and it seems like for aerospace companies, like a price to book of like 2 or so is reasonable probably. But so I think just a little based on that, there's quite a bit of upside. I mean, they have to prove it. They also have to produce free cash flows, which they were struggling in the past. So
yeah,
but if they can do that, I think it will re-rate quickly.
So most of our conversation, I guess, when I did the analysis, I'll admit it, I mostly looked at the consumer engine division, right, for the commercial flight, sorry. And, you know, I kind of glazed over the other parts as well, of the business as well. And obviously they're smaller parts. But did you guys do any more deep dive in terms of their defense spending and their... the MTU power systems. I mean, most of the analysis I read, it was kind of like they just, you know, assume status quo that they're just going to keep on going. And it was like mostly the commercial aviation division that you're trying to make a prediction on. But I don't know. Could things change in the defense and the power systems as well that could impact overall performance? Eric, did you look at that?
Yeah. So from what I saw, defense seems to be just a very stable business, stable margins, stable revenue. Defense doesn't really grow very quickly. It kind of grows at GDP because the U.S. has been keeping their defense spending. They've raised it in the past few years, but it hasn't been, you know, increasing large and large amounts over the past 40 years. I looked at their power systems business because I thought that would be very interesting. And I actually really like the stuff that their head, Andreas Schell, has done in the past few years. They used to make 850 different types of engines, and they're consolidating that down to 500. They're also taking a page out of the Civil Aerospace book, and they're focusing more on long-term service agreements for some of their larger and high-tech engines that they use to power things like haul trucks or yachts or things of that nature. And then they're also shifting some of their production of the less cutting-edge engines to places like India and China, and that seems to make sense to me, So I expect, you know, decent performance out of the power systems division and the low single digit revenue growth for the next few years, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to predict whether that business will shrink over time or grow. I would say it's likely to grow. I grew up in Germany. I was born in Germany, and this their power systems, it's originally MTU Friedrichshafen, has a very good name there. It kind of had long connection with Mercedes-Benz and Daimler. Yeah. So I don't know. I think they have a good market positioning there, and they, like, it has been pretty stable. Like the defense and the power system, to me, it looks like they're have reasonable good profitability over the last few years. Like the whole issue seems to be around the civil aerospace kind of engines. If they can really start producing cash flow and earnings out of that business unit, then I think there's a lot of upside. I don't think there's huge downside on the other two businesses. I think they're reasonable good businesses.
Good. All right, so let's kind of move on here, and let's just kind of talk about something things that we don't like about this business. There's negatives to every business. So, Eric, is there anything that concerns you with Rolls-Royce?
Yeah, the biggest thing, I think we already touched on it, was the Trent 1000. Initially, when they found out that there were going to be issues with it in like 2017, they were a little slow to react. But since then, I've been a little bit happier that they've really put a lot of resources and manpower into fixing it. It looks like it's going to be sorted out by around 2023. And I guess another risk is with machines this complicated, if another one of their engines were to develop issues, then that would be a significant drawback, because then they would have to spend, you know, another few hundred million or maybe even a billion every year to deal with that. So I would be looking very carefully to see if any of their other engines face any issues. One of the big other risks is obviously they're based out of the UK and Brexit is happening, and that's probably going to cause a lot of uncertainty, particularly in the supply chain. I'm happy that they've kind of tried to mitigate that by stocking up on extra inventory, and they've added 2 billion of inventory since the Brexit vote happened. And if that doesn't quell the problem, they've also have a backup plan to assemble more of their engines in the US and Germany. So those are two risks, but it looks like they have their eyes on them, and hopefully they won't get out of control.
Okay. Is there the risk of having another issues with another engine? I was just curious, if they announced they did have another issue with a different engine, would that be an automatic reason for you to sell your position?
To this point, since they haven't had any issues with the other engines, well, really, the Trent 7000, if it has a little bit of an issue, it won't be a problem. They only have 100 engines out there. But if the XWB develops issues at the same scale as the Trent 1000, they're making a lot more of those engines every year. So if the Trent XWB faces problems like the Trent 1000, yeah, I'll be out of there pretty quick, I would say.
Okay, good to know. Felix, do you got anything to add there?
I have some kind of risks or negatives, but Eric, did you have anything else that you wanted to bring up? Not to cut you off.
Sure, yeah. Since they learned about the Trent 1000 issues, they redesigned the intermediate pressure compressor blade, I think, for the 7000. And then they also, they don't believe that there is as much risk with the high pressure turbine blade for the 7000, because they have lower thrust climb ratings than the Trent 1000. So I was just reading that this today. So I don't believe that the 7000 will get any issues. If it does, I think it'll be manageable. But the big risk really is the XWB. That is the crown jewel of their civil aviation division.
Right.
Okay. So some of the kind of negatives I saw was poor earnings and free cash flow, I think, in the last 10, 15 years from the data that I looked. It's not a business where I can say like, oh yeah, it's kind of like Berkshire Hathaway, every year a little bit better, a little bit better. Kind of not that kind of consistency. And Yeah, I think they have good revenue growth, but there's no free cash flow, small dividend, no share buybacks, so that's something I don't like that much. To me, they have a poor history of converting their kind of market position or their technological kind of strengths into economic gain. I don't know what exactly is the reason behind that, poor management or maybe a fluke kind of issues with the Trend 1000, but it just feels like this should be a more profitable business than it was in the past. Maybe that's a positive, but anyways, I'll kind of put it down as a negative. It's capital intensive, is something to think about. Sure, there could be other Trend 1000, issues with the other engines, like the Trend 1000. I could also see some risk, if something happens like the 737 MAX grounding, like if that happened to one of their planes, like let's say the A350, that would definitely kind of be an issue for their earnings, I think. And or like a plane gets discontinued, like the A380, and then have to do write downs. So certainly not a business kind of like Gillette razor and blade. The business model, I agree, is similar, but there's a lot more kind of risks attached to it. I don't know, could they underestimate their maintenance costs in the long-term service agreements? I don't think so. I think they're being conservative, but if some kind of issue happens, like on the Trent 1000, they're certainly not making any money on that engine. Maybe they're probably losing a little bit, but maybe it gets fixed, and then over the lifetime of that engine, I guess you would expect the Trent 1000 still to be profitable. I think ValueAct just quit the board. I don't know how you guys feel about that. I think they're the largest shareholder, and I guess I'm not that concerned if they don't feel like they were making the kind of returns that they were expecting. And they want out. To me, that's a sign they kind of want to sell their shares if they quit the board. And I kind of just see it as like an overhang maybe of shares that, you know, they might want to sell. So a lot of supply of shares that, you know, have to be kind of bought up. And the coronavirus, I don't think it's probably over the next 5 or 10 years an issue, but I could see anything kind of travel related, airplane related, mm-hmm. to kind of get cheaper over the next 2 to 5, 6 months or so. And then I'm assuming it's going to get better again with the virus, but maybe it's worthwhile waiting. But maybe then the share price kind of people catch on that it is a pretty good deal and that management is really executing well. And this might kind of run away from me, kind of the share price. I don't know, but I think that's a consideration worthwhile. I don't know what you guys think about those things. Maybe ValueAct or coronavirus, maybe you want to comment on those.
Sure. Yeah. So ValueAct, I think they were a really good influence on the business. And I think they helped push to make sure that the management was changed back in 2015. Let's just say that the previous management, I looked at their performance and it was lacking. At ValueAct, I believe they had one man that quit the board in December. And since their latest release, I haven't seen them sell any shares. So unless they do that, I'm not really going to be too worried. In terms of coronavirus, yes, airlines are going to be hit pretty hard for the next year, probably over coronavirus. But in the entire value chain of air travel, probably the most insulated is the engine manufacturers, because they have such long contracts and they have such large order books for their engines. I was reading a little bit about coronavirus the other day, and if you look at, even at the short-term effects, there's this guy, Mark Lipsitch. He's a Harvard epidemiologist. He modeled out that about 40 to 70% of the people he thought in the U.S. will get the virus. And then I was reading this guy's paper. His name's Christian Althaus. He's an epidemiologist from Switzerland. And he was saying that it looks like the case fatality rate is between 0.4 and 4.1%, with a median at 1.6%. And most of those people are above 80 or like 60 to 80. So I don't know how much those people travel. So yeah, I see this coronavirus particularly as a short-term demand shock and not really going to affect the long-term value of the business.
Yeah, I would agree with that statement. I'm just kind of wondering if maybe this might push down the share price in the next, like I said, 2 to 5 months or so.
Might see another couple of weeks what we experienced last week, 10% dips.
And I don't know, you know, if it's a really good deal right now, which probably Rolls-Royce does seem like a good deal to me, kind of in terms of their earnings and free cash flow versus their share price or their market cap or their enterprise value. But so maybe you should just buy it. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. But that's just on my mind. I'm keeping a little bit of cash right now, kind of seeing if stocks can go a little bit lower in the next little while. So that's kind of part of what's holding me back a little bit.
Yeah, I think I have the Monish Pabrai curse where whenever I buy, it immediately goes down 10 or 20%.
I've had that issue lately too.
Yeah.
I think Felix, unless you have anything else to add, I got just a few things. I agree with you on the numbers. Like the cash flow hasn't been overly impressive in the past 12 years. Really hasn't. And maybe it'll turn around, but like in terms of, if you just look at the history, you know, recent history of 12 years, it hasn't really, produced much. And, so I don't know. I know they're forecasting next year to be a big cash flow year. I think $1 billion. By the end of the year. So, you know, hopefully that works out for them. And one of my biggest concerns, I guess, with the business is like, knowing, having a little bit of background on, you know, contract negotiation and whatnot. I know that there's a lot of resources dedicated to the most expensive components of large machinery or planes or trucks. And so you have a lot of, employee resources are dedicated to negotiation on those types of things and in terms of the maintenance as well. So I know that's a problem when you look at a company like TransDigm, who focuses on buying the little parts that are, you know, to a plane that are proprietary and low cost. You know, no one really pays attention to those regardless of the profit margins they have on this business. So when you have an engine that's, you know, 20 to 25% of the overall cost and really drives 50% of your operating cost, there's always going to be a lot of attention there. And I think that translates to, you know, sometimes it's a difficult, you know, it's very difficult for them to make money because you have these, they design these contracts with unit rates that, you know, force the engine manufacturers to really take a bet on what the productivity or efficiencies of their engines are before they've really been in operation for a long time. So that's one of the negatives I found in the business that you guys haven't mentioned.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with you. Certainly there's a lot more focus on that, and that's why they're losing money on each engine sold. But just based on the business model, you're like in a duopoly and maybe in a monopoly on some engines, or some airframes. That should play again in the favor a little bit of Rolls-Royce. So,
well, I mean, that's the curious thing about the whole thing. It's like you think because there is such a position, I would have thought they'd be a lot more profitable, but they spend a lot of money on research and development and patents and whatnot.
CapEx.
So.
Personally, I wouldn't want them to decrease their spending in research and development. I think that's what gives them their moat. I would just like them to be more effective at making sure that they can get the most value out of the engine as possible. I guess maybe we'll talk about this when the moat and competitors comes up, but GE has done a really, really great job of getting the most value out of each one of their engines. Rolls-Royce, in comparison, historically has bought a lot of the components for their engines from suppliers, and often they've left a lot out on the table.
Yeah, I guess there is, like, I think when we look at the past, we can agree the numbers aren't that great, but I think there's a case to be made that the future might be brighter. And yeah. And then it's kind of what's the likelihood? Like, I guess that's everybody's own kind of. If you believe what management's saying, and you know what, I could see them reach it, then the stock is very, very cheap. So anyways, we'll get to valuation and that sort of topics. Right. Yeah. I think let's talk about management then. If you guys are good with that. Eric, you want to start off?
Yeah, sure. So they changed their CEO and their CFO around 2015, 2016. Their CEO is a man named Warren East. He came from Arm Holdings. And Steve Daintith came from, I think he came from a tobacco company. I could be wrong. But so far in their plans, they've been delivering on their 2018 goals. And I'm pretty pleased with their execution up to this point. They decided that they needed to restructure to cut out a lot of middle management, because Rolls-Royce was legendarily bloated in terms of bureaucracy and things of that nature. They got the help of a restructuring firm to actually help them with their planning on that. And one of the things that I particularly like about the management is it seems like they worry a lot about helping the investor understand what is happening within the business. So an example was after the full year 2018 results, there were a lot of questions that were sent to them about the long-term service agreements and how exactly the contracts affect the cash flow and the earnings. So in the next call in the first half of 2019, the CFO spent at least 5 minutes explaining in detail exactly how the contracts affect the cash flow. And I guess as a rookie investor, I can just really appreciate that. And it shows at least a level of transparency that I like to see in management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with transparency. And I would say everything he says and kind of does, it's as a shareholder, you want to hear that. And you want to, and so far they've delivered basically on what they said. Any other comment on management? So I'd say he did a fantastic job at ARM Holdings. I think the revenue or so went 10x or so over a 10-year span. I don't know the exact numbers, but it was pretty good. But, you know, it was also probably an easier business to kind of manage when he came in. So I don't think he'll have as easy a job at Rolls-Royce, but I do like what he says makes sense. And so far I think they have delivered. I do like how he handles the Trent 1000 issues. Maybe they could have been a little bit more aggressive right away, but I think they're kind of trying to do everything to make the customer happy. I think that's the biggest concern, and give airlines the confidence to buy that engine. So that, and even the other engines, so the airlines know they're taken care of if there are any troubles. I like the reorg. I like that he pushes hard to increase free cash flow. I think he identified that as a big issue, that they weren't really generating free cash flow. And he's pushing for that. And so far, the free cash flow has increased every year, and costs based compared to revenue have gone down. The losses on the engines have gone down on the OE or the original equipment, and the margins on the maintenance has gone up. So I don't know. I think a lot of positives. I would also say that, you know, the way if you had some issues in the company, and I mean, to a certain extent, the Trent 1000, I think there's also some kind of luck involved. But if you had bad management and you made bad decisions, it's going to take very long time to correct that pass in this business. You know, you have to live with these engines for, I don't know, 35 years or so. So, I don't expect free cash flow being zero, and then the next year it's $2 billion. It's not going to happen. So I think they're very methodic about step-by-step getting to where they want to go. And so far they've delivered. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Mr. East and Mr. Daintith, I think they've been in for about 4 or 5 years, and so far they've talked the talk and so far they've walked the walk. I guess it's just a matter of whether they continue to do so. I'm hopeful, but I guess gotta see it with open eyes, and hopefully they continue to progress and there are no setbacks.
Good. Alex, do you have anything to add on management?
I don't really have much to add on that. You know, I think they've pretty much done what would be expected to do given the situation they're in. I don't think they've done, they haven't done a horrible job, and I think they've done a professional job handling the issue and managing the business. I guess I'm not ecstatic, but I'm kind of indifferent, sitting in the middle there.
Okay. Mode and competitors.
Yeah, I guess we've talked about this a little bit already. You know, they have a strong position as one of the few suppliers of wide-body engines in the world. Not one competitor. I don't have too much to add. What about you, Eric?
Yeah, so over the past 4 or 5 years, Rolls-Royce has really, really increased its market share in terms of wide-body engines. They currently have 2/3 of the order book for wide-body engines, so they're going to continue to increase their market share. GE is really their only competitor in the wide-body engine space. I was looking to see if there were any like Russian or Chinese companies, and what I could find on one of the Chinese engines being developed said that it might be developed by 2030. So let's just say that they're not going to be a threat anytime soon. GE is a very, very capable company, particularly their aviation business. They have much higher operating margins than Rolls-Royce. However, Rolls-Royce is catching up and they're copying a lot of what GE did. GE right now is going through a bit of a, well, past 3 or 4 years, going through a bit of a financial meltdown. So they're taking a lot of their earnings from the aviation business and using it to shore up their other struggling subsidiaries. The thing that GE did that Rolls-Royce should really look at, and a thing that they are looking at, is GE took advantage of new 3D printing and additive manufacturing processes so that if there was a really high margin part that they needed, if they couldn't buy it from a supplier cheaply, they would build their own plant. I think they built a couple of plants in Mississippi and Alabama and then installed 3D printers, and then they could go to the bargaining table and say, okay, company X, you want to sell us this part? Well, you either sell it for this price or we make it ourselves. And Rolls-Royce is finally starting to do a little bit of that. Another thing GE did is they made a bunch of really strategic acquisitions to make sure that they took as much of the value chain within their company as possible. And Rolls has started to do a little bit of that. They purchased the rest of ITP Aero. They owned about half of it and they purchased the rest of it to bring more of that high margin manufacturing within the company and try to get more of the value of the engine in-house, which I can appreciate. But yeah, GE, very capable company. I haven't seen anything on if GE is developing a brand new engine. I know that Rolls is developing its new UltraFan, which will be out in the mid-2020s. But if GE doesn't, you know, keep up with their technology, then Rolls is going to continue to take more market share, which as a shareholder, I'm more than glad about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think if they could maintain kind of that market share, or like when you, not the current, but the order book going forward, I think that would already be good. I think GE, I heard they kind of had some discussions with Airbus to kind of open up new engine options on some of the Airbus models so that they could start bidding again. So I would be surprised if GE is not kind of making a push to kind of be competitive in some areas. Do you think they have like a competitive advantage, GE, just based on their size? Like, I think the aviation business being in the single aisle airplanes, and also kind of as overall the business being much bigger than Rolls-Royce.
Perhaps, but I don't see it being a major factor in terms of competitive advantage going forward. I know that GE, yeah, they have been in discussions, I think, with Airbus over adding an engine option on the A330neo and the A350 XWB. I think they whispered about that, but the A350, yeah, but the XWB is still much more efficient than their engines. So unless they come out with a brand, then it looks like it's going to be mostly run by the XWB and the Trent 7000 for the next few years, at least.
Yeah, I think for the next few years, like, it takes a while to develop the new engine and then to get it into service and everything, right? So
yeah, if it was an existing engine, then it wouldn't take as long. But if you want to go from a drawing to having one on a plane and putting it on the assembly line, it's usually 5 years to develop an engine and then 5 years to test it and get it flight ready. So there's a lot of visibility with when competition is coming, when new models are coming out. And like Rolls-Royce has already been signaling that they're going to be bringing out their UltraFan in the mid-2020s at some point. And to this point, I haven't seen anything on GE. Maybe they have something in the Skunk Works, but I haven't seen anything.
So to me, like, when I look at it, it looks like they really are in a very strong competitive position, but it's kind of like I'm repeating myself. It's kind of the past numbers haven't really shown that strong mode to me, the financial numbers. It's something that kind of I have to kind of agree in my head. Maybe going forward, they, you know, what's the management that I feel quite comfortable with, maybe it's looking better going forward. I think Eric, you definitely feel like the past isn't necessarily an indication of what's happening in the next few years.
Right. Yeah. The way I look at this is a restructuring and a turnaround story. They don't have the consistency of like a railroad or a utility, right? This is a business where they have had, you know, they should have had much higher margins over the past 10 years. In the first five of the decade, the first 5 years of the decade, they had some management that, let's say, wasn't the most talented, and hopefully they're coming to grips with most of these issues now and putting more value of the engine within Rolls-Royce rather than just giving it to their competitors. It's not a utility. It's not something where you can look at the numbers and just say, okay, well, grew at this rate and their margins were stable at this percentage, therefore it will be this in the future. You kind of have to leave some of the past behind and just look towards what's going to happen in the future. A lot of the trouble that they had in the past 5-10 years was they spent just a ridiculous amount of money to develop these new engines. And what happens in a cycle of when you're building an engine is you sink a bunch of money into it, and then you lose money on the engines when you sell them to customers, and then you make back that money that you've spent plus the profit on the services. So they've already sunk all that money into these new engines. It was the most capital intensive time of the company's entire history. And now we're getting to the part where their service revenues are going to climb much more quickly than revenues overall. And this should be where their profits finally show up.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty long cycle for this stuff. And, you know, when you're used to looking at, you know, consumer staples like Coca-Cola, or like you said, Eric, like, railways, it's completely different businesses. And, you know, 12 years of investing to benefit in the next 10 or 15 years is probably not that abnormal in this type of industry.
Can we take a quick break? And when we come back, maybe discuss growth and free cash flow. I've been at it for like 50 minutes and my throat's getting a bit itchy.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, okay. All right, we'll give you a call back there. Right.
Yeah, bye.
And thanks. And to the listeners, please remember, it's not investment advice. We're not certified financial advisors. So do your own due diligence. Thank you. Bye. Hey, Eric, welcome back.
Okay.
Welcome back to part two.
Part two of Rolls-Royce. Here we are. We left off on cash flow here, and, you know, it's 5 minutes ago, but I don't remember where we were.
Yeah, we talked about management, I think.
Oh, yeah,
I know, that's right. Competition.
Yeah.
And I guess we can go into gross and free cash flow use. I'll start off just looking at some of the numbers. I saw 7% CAGR for revenue growth over the last 14 years. And then I saw no free cash flow. And basically all the operating cash flow being reinvested in the business. It paid like a small dividend, probably a little bit less than 2%, but at the same time increased debt in the business. So the equity went from slightly positive to slightly negative. And over those 14 years, the share count stayed flat. So to me, what the business value kind of delivered for shareholders is probably the revenue growth of like about 7% kind of annually. And maybe the shareholders might have done a little bit worse if we're talking about relative valuations kind of the stock price. But just kind of what the business, what I see over the last 14 years, I think they grew kind of the intrinsic value maybe by 7% annually. If they keep growing at 7% going forward in terms of revenue, but at the same time can produce free cash flow that can be used for an increased dividends, reducing debt, or especially repurchasing shares, then I think you can have a pretty good return going forward. That's kind of my opinion. Eric?
Yeah, the revenue growth, probably in the past, it's been 7% for, like you said, the last 14. Over the next 10, that it would be less. They've done a lot of growing their market share, and you can't keep growing at high rates. Well, 7% is an extremely high rate, but I would expect them to grow probably in the mid-single digits over the next 10 years. I know that passenger kilometers for airlines is projected to have a cumulative annual growth rate of 3.7% from 2016 to 2035. So if the revenue is a little bit higher than that, then yeah, we'd be right in the range of the mid-single digits. In terms of what their free cash flow use should be over the next 10 years or so, I think that they should look at buybacks if there are no sensible acquisitions like the ITP Aero acquisition or other uses of cash to grow the business. I think buybacks would substantially benefit, and I think that it'd be a great use of capital allocation personally over a dividend, for instance.
Yeah. You're right. I was like, I didn't really consider that, but that 7% is probably not repeatable. I think they also bought part of the power business of the MTU from, I think, Daimler, the 50% that they didn't own in the meantime. So that would probably have part of that revenue increase as well. So, yeah, I think probably like maybe 4 or 5% going forward. Does that sound more reasonable?
Yeah, because I think the airline business will probably, if they have, you know, 4% passenger growth, plus they're able to get a extra couple percent by increasing prices on engines, then yeah, you're going to be at 5, 6, 7% growth in the civil aviation department, and then maybe 4 or 5% growth in power systems, and then defense is going to be rather stable, 1 or 2%, I would think. So yeah, 4 or 5% as a group seems about right to me.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I'll assume 4% if I look at my numbers to be conservative. Sounds good to you, Alex? Or
yeah, I mean, I think we're almost diving into evaluation almost at this point. I had the same thing, the numbers there, 7% on top line growth. Free cash flow was negligible, like the growth there. What was interesting to stand out is how much they, you know, spend on intangible assets every year, which has been pretty consistent over the past 12 years. And I mean, that's all that was the history I looked at. So it's quite significant part of their business.
I would say free cash flow has grown a lot, like in I guess this past year they just did 900 million And then for 2020, now they're forecasting $1 billion.
Right. Yeah.
Like their earnings call was just last week, yeah. I think, for the full year 2019. So I guess,
I mean, if their margins, you know, the gross margin is single digits, and I mean, then they've had higher gross margins in the past. So, you know, really, if you just apply that, those margins against their, you know, a larger revenue, you know, that it's easy to come get to a very high number for free cash flow. If you just kind of prorate that down the cash flow statement there. So, it's reasonable to think like that they could have a lot better performance in the future. It's just that, yeah, in the past 12 years, it hasn't really shown too much, but, yeah.
Well, this kind of leads into the valuation. Do you guys think you're ready to jump into that yet?
Do we have anything else to talk about?
I guess free cash flow, we've got to have some kind of consensus, or at least like understand what you guys are expecting going forward.
Let's just dive into valuation there.
No, I disagree. What, like one slide, and Eric, we talked about that before from the earnings call.
Yep.
The presentation slide number 42, which is shows operating profit, and then it kind of shows a waterfall kind of chart or steps to get to at least $1 billion free cash flow in 2020. I find that a pretty helpful kind of slide, and at the same time it makes me a bit wondering about the free cash flows, because of that $1 billion free cash flow, for example, there's $600 million of working capital contribution, like led by inventory unwind.
Yeah, what I assume that is I assume that's going to be part of them unwinding the $2 billion worth of inventory that they built up for Brexit. So over the next year, you know, if they unwind $600 million for the next 3 years, then they will have kind of come back to the level that they were at before the Brexit vote of around $2 billion in inventory. So that's what I'm assuming it's from. I could be wrong.
No, I think you're correct, but I'm just saying it's going to make the free cash flow look good over the next 3 years, but then that's going to disappear. It's not, you can't do that indefinitely.
Right.
On the other hand, the $500 million that they have for the next 2 years in payments for the Trent 1000, that's going to disappear as well. So that kind of cancels out, I guess.
Yeah, this is kind of leading into my valuation of them, dealing with, you know, Trent 1000 costs and stuff. Do you mind if I just hop right into that? And then I'd love to hear your guys' sure. opinions, because as people that don't own the stock, I always like to hear more unbiased opinions than mine, let's say.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so 2019, they made about $900 million in core free cash flow. And then they had Trent 1000 costs of $578 million, but then they also got insurance receipts for those costs of $173. So if you net it out, they had about $400 million in Trent 1000 costs. So if they weren't having all the issues they were with the Trent 1000, they'd be making, as of last year, $1.3 billion in free cash flow. And then in 2018, they did a capital markets day where they identified three core drivers that they expected to increase their ability to generate free cash. And one of those was less engine losses. Like I said a little bit earlier, they lose about $1.2 million for every engine that they sell. And they said that by 2022, they want to bring that down to $400,000 for every engine that they sell. So that's $800,000 saved for 500 engines. It's about $400 million in savings. So if you add the $400 million to the $1.3, you get about $1.7 billion. And then they said that they wanted to add $700 million in terms of their aftermarket cash margin. So that comes from them adding planes into their installed engine base, and also having planes with higher margins like the XWB. and they wanted to get 700 million by 2022. They've already reached 600 million. So I think it's very, very possible that they reach the last 100 million in the next 2 years. So if you add another 100 million, they're at 1.8 billion in free cash flow. And then they've been doing a bunch of restructuring where they said that they were going to save about 400, 500 million. And they're most of the way through that. And there's probably another 150, 180 million in costs that they say they can cut out. So if you add that on, that gets them to about 1.98. So call it 2 billion in free cash flow by 2022, 2023, depending on when the Trent 1000 costs are finally over. And then most companies in the aerospace industry with really steady cash flows and high barriers to entry, such as Rolls-Royce, they have a free cash less than 5%. But let's say that Rolls is the least liked out of the bunch and they get a free cash flow yield in the market of 5 to 8% in 2023, based on the 2 billion in free cash flow, then they would have a market cap of between 25 and 40 billion, or about 210% to about 330% higher than it is right now. That's accounting for all the growth in the, that's without accounting for all the growth in the installed engine base. And that probably continue throughout the 2020s with the development of the UltraFan. So I got to about 40, trying to be as conservative as I can.
You're saying 25 to 40 billion
pounds, yeah.
In 5 years from now, or current intrinsic value?
No, if they make 2 billion in free cash flow in 2023, then if they're valued as their peers or even much worse than their peers, then they'll be at probably 25 to 40.
Yeah.
And that's reaching all the targets that you laid out.
That's if they reach all those targets, yes. So if they miss some of them, obviously, then it's going to be lower. But if they're valued at the same level of their peers also, then it'll be higher. So I tried to give it a bit of a balance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got, if I assume we're currently at 1 billion free cash flow and we're giving us a 20 multiple, which I think is, it's fair. It's probably cheap because that's just free cash flow. That's not earnings. Because they're also investing in capital on top of that. Mm-hmm. So 20 is a fair multiple, probably, and probably cheap in today's market conditions. That would be currently, it'd be worse, maybe 20 billion. That is, if I believe that 1 billion free cash flow is like a normalized free cash flow through the cycle, or not like ignoring one-time items. When you kind of went through your kind of waterfall just now, like it just, you started with the 1 billion free cash flow in 2020, and then you started adding the Trent 1000 issues being resolved. But did you subtract kind of like the working capital not decreasing indefinitely, because that's 600 million of the 1 billion in free cash flow in 2020.
Yeah, I didn't account for free cash flow. I just took what their 900 million, and then I adjusted for the Trent 1000 costs and for the three drivers that they said were going to increase their free cash flow margin. I didn't worry about the working capital because I don't think it's something that you can rely on over the long term. So I was trying to be a little bit more conservative in my estimates, I would say.
Yeah. Maybe you send me your kind of Excel file so I can look through it. It would be helpful to me. Like I was struggling a little bit getting to that 1.9 billion in free cash flow that management is assuming. Maybe in the long run, just by just ever increasing kind of the engines in service, but just by the kind of cost savings in the near term, I don't quite get there.
Okay. Yeah, it's important to mention too that between now and when they launch the UltraFan, or when they really ramp up on the UltraFan, this is going to be the most profitable time for Rolls-Royce. Once they start having to put more money towards producing the UltraFan, then profit margins will drop because they'll be investing more in the next engine. But while they're not spending money on a lot of engine development and they're just collecting money from these service revenues, this is going to be a very profitable time, or it should be the most profitable time of the cycle of the engine cycle.
Mm. Yeah. I guess there's definitely some good upside potential when we're considering it's trading at a 12 billion pound market cap right now. If you assume like they can get to 1.5 billion or 1.9 billion in free cash flow and you put a multiple on there, then yes, you are talking at 3x, 4x potential, I guess.
Yeah, and I think they guided for about 1.2 billion in free cash flow, like obviously this year, but if you back out the Trent 1000 costs, I think they guided for just about where they are right now back in 2018, 2017 during the capital markets day. So it seems like they have some visibility and that it's not too rocky.
Yeah, I think they understand their numbers a little bit better than I understand their numbers. So yeah, you know, I wouldn't put it past them that they get to that 1.9, but one other way I looked at it, just because I don't just want to do free cash flow. So I always kind of look at some different ways of valuing the company. And if you look at kind of price to sales, and I mentioned that earlier, United Technologies trading at 2 and Safran at 2.5 versus Rolls-Royce right now trading at 0.8. And Rolls-Royce has about 15.5 billion, I think they did in sales in 2019, roughly. So if you do like a price to sales of 1.5, you also get to like a 22 billion market cap kind of maybe intrinsic value right now.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, so that's just interesting.
Just something to think about. But
yeah. Yeah. I tried to look at earnings and all I could come up with, and this was just kind of rough thinking before the podcast, was if they end up making 2 billion in free cash flow, you know, 2022, 2023, and then they get taxed at 20%, which is, you know, the average between the UK and the US corporate rates, then they'll be left with about 1.6 billion in earnings. And then I was looking at some of their, you know, competitors, some of the people that that have similar businesses to them, and they were all trading at price earnings before the coronavirus issues of around 25 to 30. So if you take 1.6 billion in earnings, and then you have a 25 to 30 price earnings on that, you get around 40 to 45, 40 to 48, around there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure if earnings would be lower than free cash flow, maybe, because I mean, sure, you have taxes and stuff, but at the same time, you also, it probably will be lower because of the long-term service agreements. But you also have CapEx that you're spending, right, in kind of growing the business. That would be added for earnings. So I don't know.
I want to hear what Alex thinks. But,
yeah.
Well, I think for me, it's kind of look at it as reminds me of Fiat Chrysler in a way when we did that podcast episode, you know, heads I win and tails I don't lose much. At least that's the way I see it. You know, I don't see a lot of downside, but I see a higher probability of upside with this because I think, you know, in Fiat Chrysler's case, you know, they already had a lot of success and that was relied upon with their Jeep brands and their truck, Dodge trucks, where I think there's a lot more margin proven opportunities with this, with Rolls-Royce. So I think, you know, I think the upside is maybe similar in terms of value, what management's seeing. But I also think that there's a higher probability of success for Rolls-Royce going forward, just because I think their organization's just, there's a lot more opportunities within it to get those, squeeze those margins. So, or not, yeah, to expand those margins. So I think right now, I think, you know, worst case scenario, I mean, it's fairly valued. Maybe there'd be downside if we went into, you know, coronavirus cause of recession globally or something, but, you know, that's recoverable. And I think you can see an upside of close to, well, 20 billion pounds or even up to 25, 30, depending on how the multiple of the market values on it. So, I mean, for me, I wouldn't think I would, you know, pay more than 20 on my estimated owner's earnings. So, yeah.
Okay.
So I don't really have a huge, I have a, you know, like, I think we all have fairly large ranges that we're evaluating this company. And I think that's just a result of
uncertainty around the future free cash flow.
Yeah. I mean, you put some faith in management because they've done a fairly good job in being transparent, and it's not like they've wildly missed their communication to investors, so they've hit the marks that they said they will. So that builds credit and confidence with me.
And you feel okay.
No, sorry, I was just going to add something in comparing it to the automobile industry, aviation. One thing that the automobile industry obviously is facing and has to spend a lot of R&D on is electrification, right? And electrification for cars is obviously going to happen fairly soon. I was trying to figure out when electrification would happen for civil aviation. And when I got into the science, it's just going to be at least 50 years before any commercial plane with a large number of people is run with electricity, because like the best batteries, they have an energy density of somewhere around, I think like the best ones being tested in labs are about 300 watt hours per kilogram. And then kerosene, the fuel for jet engines, is like 13,500 watt hours per kilogram. So unless batteries improve, 33, 35 times, not quite that much, because supposedly an electric engine would be more efficient with the energy, but still, it's just such a large disparity between the energy density of the fuels, where that's an area where aviation has a significant advantage over automobiles, at least in terms of investing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of electrification, I know they're testing small planes out in Victoria and Vancouver with the, was it Harbor Air or whatever, that goes back and forth.
Okay.
But that's, they state, the main issue is the weight and how much energy they can store in a battery. Like, because the batteries are quite heavy, and that takes up the how much they can actually carry in passengers.
Yeah, if they wanted to use all electric on a A350, then great job, you can carry two people.
Yeah. So those economics don't work anymore.
So Alex, you already said it's limited downside. Do you guys have any thoughts on kind of what's worst case scenario?
Yeah, I looked at downside kind of crudely a few hours ago, and I was just thinking, if everything went wrong with civil aviation, what would the business be worth with just defense and power systems? And I thought, okay, maybe, they have problems with the XWB, which I don't think they will. And maybe they have problems with the Trent 7000, which I don't think they will. And then they end up selling off, that civil aviation portion of the business, and they only get enough money back to pay their debts that they have on the civil aviation business. Well, then you're left with power systems and defense. And in the last year, they produced $750 million in earnings. And if you just kind of roughly slap a 15 times earnings multiple on that, you get a market cap of 11.2 billion pounds, which is essentially the market cap of today. So if you were, in my mind, valuing this fairly, they're trading today as if they didn't have a civil aviation division.
Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of fair. I didn't really think in terms of the engines kind of going wrong, but I saw it. Are they going to increase their revenue going forward, that business? I think they will keep increasing their revenue. I think they're going to have more engine hours, on average, bigger engines. So do I see even if they don't make any money for a while, I think just alone growing the revenue and having potential of making money in the future, you kind of trade at some kind of price to sales ratio. So I don't really see this business in jet engines. Maybe with coronavirus or so, I can see it trading at 0.5 times sales, but I don't really see that business with that kind of a quality potential trading at 0.5 sales forever. And I don't really see their earnings collapsing. I actually think they will. It's very likely that their not earnings, their revenue. I think it's very likely that the revenue will keep growing. So I kind of see over the next few years, I see the downside kind of as the stock kind of staying around the current level. And that's kind of my downside. It's kind of the risk I feel is kind of that they don't really increase their free cash flow, and they just keep reinvesting in the business, and so the business kind of keeps muddling along, and your cost is like your opportunity cost. That's your downside to me. Like, I don't want to be invested in that business for 5-10 years and not getting any return on it. But I don't see that you can kind of have a complete loss in this business the way it stands today.
Do you guys, either of you guys know like what percentage of aviation traffic is down in China right now due to the coronavirus? Just out of curiosity.
I don't know within China, but I think I was hearing that some of the carriers that go to China, like obviously the US has shut off travel to China. Yeah. So I think international travel into China has dropped like 40-50%. But again, I think they assume that they'll be able to get a vaccine within 12 to 18 months. So that is kind of the window where this will be affecting the business. And I'm not buying, I wouldn't be owning this for the next 12 to 15 months. I'm trying to own it until, you know, at least 2030, 2035.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just that, I mean, that's a short-term thing if you believe in the long-term economics of the business, but it'd just be interesting because, you know, if there's less engine hours on the airplanes, if they're, I don't know if they can relocate the wide-body aircraft to another route that easily, but, you know, that impacts their cash flow at least.
Another thing I don't know is if a plane goes from, you know, 90% filled to 60% filled, it's still flying, right? So they will be hit less than the airlines. The airlines are probably going to get hit the worst, and then after that, it'll probably be the aircraft body manufacturers, Boeing and Airbus, and then I would expect at the very, very safest end of that chain, the engine manufacturers. But, hey, maybe I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm. So if everything did drop, you know, all things equal, is Rolls-Royce in the aviation business, or at least industry, is Rolls-Royce your choice for the best opportunity possibly? I mean, it's all price dependent, I guess, but say things all were equal, like, or would you want to invest in an airline that dropped about the same amount or another supplier?
So with me trying to get away from, you know, statistically cheap and going towards quality, I'm definitely, this is an actual thing that happened back in December. So, I sold a little bit of Air Canada and put it into Rolls Royce, and I'm not regretting it so far.
Good stuff.
Okay. Is this an above average business? I would say, I believe it's an above average business. Eric, I'm gathering from your comments, you strongly believe it's an above average business. Alex, yeah? No? Average?
Yeah, I'd say it's slightly above average. I wouldn't say, I don't know. Like, time will tell, I guess, over the next 5 years to see how things play out. I mean, the problem is it's, you know, you're looking at Rolls-Royce, which is public, and you can see all their data, and then your next competitor, GE, I mean, and their results are kind of been buried inside the other GE results, right? So it's hard to really...
apples to apples predict. Is not so easy.
Yeah.
I thought it was an above-average business, but hasn't performed like...
Yeah, that's basically where my mind is, too, that it's an above-average business, and they have historically over the past 10, 15 years underperformed, and hopefully they're getting to grips with most of those issues. And to this point, I think they are.
So, and I guess we can all agree I don't know, Eric, you and I at least agree it's cheap right now.
Yeah. I see the downside as pretty minimal, which is one of the things I really try to look at. So I would say it's below average personally.
Alex, you think it's cheap or?
I think it's
might be
to
fairly.
To me, I wouldn't buy right now. I don't think it's super cheap enough for me to buy in. I would hope for at least another 20% drop before I'd really start looking at adding that to my portfolio. But that's more margin of safety, right? Built in to where I'd want to buy. So I think it's reasonably priced right now for what's going forward, based on the risks that we outlined and what could go wrong. But then, you know, for me, I'd want another 20% drop for margin of safety to buy in. But
okay. On a scale of 1 to 10, Eric, like, what do you rate that business kind of in your portfolio, or in terms of interest, or
compared to other stocks? So I've spent the most time on it, and it's probably affected me the most. So I would put it probably at a 7. I really like that they have the long runway with air travel growing. I really like that it's a completely duopolistic the two players, and I like that it has a really large and widening moat as they keep it advancing their technology. People trying to catch them, like if, for instance, Pratt and Whitney were to try to come back into the wide body game, they would have a lot of work to make up, right? The things that make me wary are the complexity of the business, which cause issues like the Trent one. Like, aviation is just really complex. You've seen that in the 737 Max issues. I mean, a 787 is 2.3 million parts alone, which is, you know, 77 times more parts than your average Toyota. So it's just technically complex. So due to that, I give it a 7. Yeah.
Yeah. I gave it a 7 too. I don't know. I don't know what to say much, but I guess I don't like it quite as much as I like my Berkshire position, but I do, but it's up there. It's, you know, I do think it's cheap, and maybe that there's potential I might invest. I don't know. Alex?
Well, I think we might be using different scales, because I rated it 7 as well, but based on what you guys just said, I just think I should re-rate it down a bit, because it, you know, sounds like you guys liked it a lot more, but okay. I think it's a good opportunity. I just need a little bit more.
Gotcha.
More
price right He's now. A cheapskate. Yeah, I get it. Selective. Totally understand.
Eric, would you consider adding to the business, like making the position higher than a 10%?
I mean, or you never say never, right? If you guys were talking about it selling at, you know, 0.5 sales. If that happened, yeah. I don't really have any cash sitting around, but I might have to open a margin account or something. I don't know.
or you sell something.
Yeah,
else.
Yeah, I might. Yeah, exactly. But at this point, I'm content with my 10. I'm going to sit on it till at least, you know, 2023, and then hopefully sit on it till 2035 or somewhere around there. That'd be great.
I'll think about it. Probably not in the next months or so, but I'll see what happens with the coronavirus, and see if it can get a little bit cheaper.
Well, there's so much turbulence in the markets right now, right? There's so many things that are bouncing around. You kind of don't have all the attention span you need to pay attention to every company you've been watching for the past 3 years. So I wouldn't blame you guys if you go into something else.
It's hard to keep track of all the big moves in stocks.
Yeah. I mean, Amazon dropped what, like 10%? Yeah. And it seems like, if anything, people staying in their homes would increase Amazon's value. So, I mean, let's just say the market isn't purely efficient, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Anyway.
Good stuff.
Do you guys have any other thoughts on the business?
I think we covered everything I went through, everything, all my notes. So unless any of you guys have anything to add, I think that's about it.
I don't have anything.
Okay.
To add.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for letting me come on. I've been a big fan, and sorry for pestering you guys so much over the past months.
Well, we appreciate you, your emails, and listening to our podcast, and we appreciate you coming on the episode today. It's nice to have someone else's perspective on some investments as well. So maybe we can have you on again.
No problem. If I find anything else interesting, I'll be sure to send it your way. Yep. See you guys.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, Eric.
Take care.